Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I told you all last week that I would backtrack slightly to Revelation 5, verse 4. We worked our way through the end of chapter 5 last week, but I skipped over the reference in verse 8 of chapter 5 where it says, "When he had taken the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials," the King James says, "full of odors." Some of your other translations will more accurately say, "full of incense." Is that what yours say? Mm-hmm. Now that's a very interesting, and again, last week I kept putting emphasis on the fact that so much of this worship-based language in chapter 4 and chapter 5 is very, very Jewish language. And this reference right here to there being golden vials full of odors or full of incense is a very interesting reference that, again, to a Gentile, not so much. But to a Jew, the notion of there being odors that are called an incense odor has a lot of Old Testament identification for a Jew. And then the author of Revelation, John, here tells us that those odors are the prayers of saints. Very interesting language. So we have to talk for a moment about what that means. There is in the Old Testament very detailed information given to Moses on Mount Sinai about building a place called the Tent of Meeting, or the tabernacle. It's also called the tabernacle in the wilderness. It's the place where every time Israel would stop moving, they would have to set up four walls. They would set up particular furniture inside those walls. And then inside the four walls would be another small room, the place where God would come and meet with the priest one day a year at the Day of Atonement. That place was called the Holy of Holies. And inside that tent was the kapporeth, the covering, the place where the blood was poured, where the pillar of cloud would come down and God would once a year take that sacrifice of atonement and accept it once a year, provided the priest did everything accurately and correctly. And right there at the door, there was a curtain that kept everybody but the high priest out of the Holy of Holies all year long. And right there by that curtain was an altar of incense. So we're going to read a little bit about that altar of incense for a moment and then see how David applied the altar of incense to prayer, and then it'll make a little more sense to you and prove that there is Old Testament precedent for John saying that the golden vials full of odors are the prayers of the saints. There's actually Old Testament basis for all of that. So let's start at the start here. Turn to Exodus 30 for a moment. Exodus chapter 30. This is in the midst of God giving Moses specific detail, very exacting detail, of this building, of the sacrifices that would take place in the building, of all of the ordinances of the building, the feasts, what the priests would wear when they came into the building, what would go on inside the tabernacle. It's all very detailed information. But God added in Exodus 30, starting at verse 1, "You will make an altar to burn incense upon. Of shittim wood shall you make it. A cubit shall be the length thereof, and a cubit the breadth thereof. Four square shall it be. Two cubits shall be the height thereof, and the horns thereof shall be of the same." So in other words, you're going to make a wooden altar. Altars are a place where things are sacrificed or burned, so there is a sacrificial element to it, otherwise it couldn't be called an altar, and it's four square. It's a square altar that's twice as high as it is wide or deep. Verse 3 then, "You will overlay it with pure gold, the top thereof, the sides thereof round about, and the horns thereof, and you will make unto it a crown of gold round about." So on top of this four square flat top, there was also going to be a ring or a crown, basically to hold the incense in once the incense was poured on the top of the altar, to hold it in place. Verse 4, "Two golden rings shall you make to it, under the crown of it, by the two corners thereof, upon the two sides of it shalt thou make it, and they shall be for the places of the staves to bear it withal. You weren't allowed, once these pieces of furniture had been consecrated to God, made holy, set aside by sacrificial blood, once that had happened, humans could no longer touch it, because that would make it unclean or impure. So when it was moved, each of these pieces of furniture would have rings on the side of them. And that's what verse 4 is talking about, that there would be golden rings on the side of it, and they would put wooden staves or wooden poles through it, and they would cover it, and then they would pick it up from each end and carry it. But nobody could touch the actual piece of furniture. So then verse 5 says, "And thou shalt make the staves of shittim wood and overlay them with gold. And thou shalt put it before the veil that is by the ark of the testimony, before the mercy seat that is over the testimony, where I will meet with thee." What that verse is saying is there was a box that was created called the Ark of the Covenant. Ark just means a container, the same way that Moses was put in an ark, or the same way that Noah was in an ark. It's a container, but on the top of that container was the kapparath, the covering, the mercy seat, the place where the blood was poured. It had two statues on it of two angels with touching wings, and the blood of the sacrifice would be poured between those. And so inside that golden box were originally just one thing, the covenant stones, the second version of the Ten Commandments in stone, were put inside that box. And that's why it's called the Ark, or the container of the covenant that was made between God and Israel, that was made in these Ten Commandments of stone. That was the Ark of the Covenant. Later, there were two other things added to it as they traveled. When Aaron's rod budded, God said, go put that in the ark. So that got put in there. And later, when the manna came, they were told to take some of the manna, put it in a golden cup, put it inside the ark. So those three things ended up inside the Ark of the Covenant. But at this point, as God is describing it, and they're just building all this stuff, the only thing that was to go in it were the tablets of stone that had the law on it. So just outside that room, right there where the covering is, there was going to be this altar of incense. Well, that's very, very interesting, the placement of it, because there was other furniture. There was like the table of showbread, that every day new bread had to be put on. There was a laver of cleansing. The very first thing that a priest saw when he came into the tabernacle was the laver of cleansing, and he had to clean himself, and it was polished high brass so that he could see his reflection, make sure it was clean before he went in. And there was, like I said, a candlestick, and there was a table of showbread, and there was an altar where the animals would be killed. But the closer you got to the actual place where you would meet God, the actual Holy of Holies, the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, the closer you got to it, the more particular the furniture became. And the further away from it, the more sort of man-based, clean yourself out here, and then move closer and sacrifice, and then get closer and show bread, speaking of Christ and his work as a perfect bread. And getting closer to it, you then find the altar of incense, and then finally you're into the Ark of the Covenant, the place where God is met. All of that had to be lined up very particularly inside the tabernacle. The thing that is closest to the Holy of Holies, the place where God met, was this altar of incense. And God was very, very particular about this altar of incense. "You shall put it before the veil that is by the ark of the testimony, before the mercy seat that is over the testimony where I will meet with thee, and Aaron shall burn thereon sweet incense every morning when he dresses the lamps," or lights the candles inside, "and he shall burn incense upon it. And when Aaron lights the lamps at evening, he shall burn incense upon it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout all your generations." So there was going to be a constant smoke of a very particular incense constantly burning before this place where the priest would meet once a year to intercede for the people, and God would accept the sacrifice as an atonement for sin. Right before that, right in front of it, I just want to stress this, right there where that meeting place was, there was this constant smoke ascending, a sweet savor up into God's nostrils. And Aaron, as a high priest, had to keep that going all the time, every morning, every night. And the reason that's interesting is because we just saw it in the book of Revelation, the golden vials of incense are identified as what? The prayers of the saints, yeah. So there is this emblem of constant prayer right there at the place where the intercessor meets with God once a year, where the interceding priest brings sacrificial blood, right there, day and night, constant prayer. And when Aaron lights the lamps at evening, he will burn incense upon it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout all your generations, nonstop prayer. And you shall offer no strange incense thereon, and you won't put a burnt sacrifice on it, because a burnt sacrifice was a sacrifice for sin. And that confuses the typology. If you were to sacrifice an animal on the altar that is specifically for incense, that confuses the typology. Sacrifice for sin, but the sacrifice of incense was a sacrifice of praise and prayer. Two different things. And he said, don't burn any kind of strange incense. What that means is, God takes the time in Exodus and in Leviticus to describe the exact kind of incense that Aaron was to put on there. And any kind of incense other than that, they were not to put on there. Also, an interesting little side note, early in the book of Leviticus, it says that an individual human, an individual person within Israel, was not allowed to make that same mixture for their personal use at home. Only in God's presence, in God's tabernacle, before God's Holy of Holies, could you have that particular incense burning. This prayer of the saints has to be only directed toward God. It is holy to God. It's personal to God. You shall offer no strange incense thereon, nor burnt sacrifice, nor meat offerings. Neither shall you pour a drink offering thereon. It was a very specific altar. Now, there was a separate altar, an altar of sacrifice. And on that, they would kill bulls, and they would kill lambs, and they would pour drink offerings, and they would burn things on that altar. But on this one, he said, no pouring, no blood. This is just incense pure to me. But an altar which bespeaks sacrifice. And Aaron shall make an atonement upon the horns of it once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonements. What that's talking about is that every piece of furniture on the Day of Atonement, every piece of furniture that was inside the tabernacle, Aaron would take some of the blood of the sacrifice, the atoning sacrifice, he would take some of it on the tip of his finger, and he would go to the corners and sanctify each of these pieces of furniture once a year as well. And so that's what he's talking about here. Not pouring blood on it, but it says the horns of it, which were the corners of it, they would go to each corner and put a little blood on it to sanctify it to God. Aaron shall make an atonement upon the horns of it once in a year with the blood of the sin offerings of atonements. Once in a year shall he make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It is most holy unto the Lord. Now, that's the altar of incense. Got that picture? Now, turn for a moment to Psalms. Psalm 141. Go there. Psalm 141. And here David is going to take that type of the altar of incense, and he's going to make the parallel between the altar of incense and prayer. So David makes that parallel long before the book of Revelation. Lord, I cry unto thee. This is verse 1 of Psalm 141. Lord, I cry unto thee. Make haste unto me. Give ear unto my voice when I cry unto thee. Let my prayer be set before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. So he has taken these two things that the high priest used to do, and still was doing in David's day, the evening sacrifice every night, and the altar of incense, where the incense had to be lit every morning and every night. And he said, let my prayer be to you like that incense. You accept that incense morning and night from the high priest. Let my prayer be like that ascending up to you. And let my hands being raised to you be as the evening sacrifice. Accept it the same way that you accept those things. So here David has drawn the parallel between prayer and incense. Got that? By the way, you know the story, do you not, of Nadab and Abihu, who I heard a Jewish fellow recently call Nadab and Abihu. And I'd always thought it was Abihu, so perhaps it's Abihu for all I know. You know what Nadab and Abihu did? Nadab and Abihu, who were two of Aaron's sons, were killed by God. And you know what for?
Strange
incense. They actually thought they could improve on the incense. They thought, well, you know, God would like it this way. God said do it this way, but I think we can do it better. I think we can create a better incense. I mean, they were just going to improve on God's plan a little bit, change it just slightly because God would like it better if we added a little bit of our effort. Sure, God said this is how it's done, but we'll just add a little bit of our effort and God will accept that. And God killed them for it and then made their two brothers go in and drag them out because you don't mess with the way God says to do things. If God says, approach me this way, you approach him that way. And if your human fleshly mind says, no, I think there's a better way to approach him. No, God does not accept you adding to your opinion of what you think is a better way to do things. God has said how to do it. Do it his way. That's the warning in that. That happens early in the book of Leviticus. Speaking of which, I just have to take 3 minutes and show you something really interesting in Leviticus, as long as I was talking about that. Turn to Leviticus 14. This has nothing to do with the subject. But, you know, I preach an absolutely sovereign God. And I extol over and over and over again the notion that God is sovereign over every event in his universe. And in Leviticus 14, there's this little phrase that you could skip right over if you weren't looking closely, but this is God talking about ceremonial cleansing. And he talks about what happens if you get leprosy, how you have to show yourself to the priest. And the priest will determine whether it's just a boil or whether it's really leprosy or whether it's just a freckle. And there's all these rules about how the priest will determine these things. And then he talks about mildew in the house. And if the mildew is growing up in your house in Israel, you take all the furniture out and you clean the house with walls and stuff. And then the priest has to come in and say that your house is clean before you can put the furniture back in and continue. If it grows up in some of your cookware or anything, you have to throw your cookware out. Got to get rid of it. Can't keep it because it's got this mildew in it. Now, you would think that something like mildew was random. I mean, if anything is just a chance occurrence, mildew, come on, right? I mean, God's in charge of the big things, war, floods, famines, tsunamis. You know, God, he's in charge of the big stuff. But if you're talking about random things, you know, birds falling out of the air, throwing a lot into the lap, the little things like, oh, mildew, God has nothing to do with that. You get out the Formula 401 stuff in. 409. Formula 401k. You get the Formula 401k, you put a little aside for your retirement, and then you spray the mildew. That's what you do. Formula 409, you spray the mildew. It's no big deal, right? Read this. This is an amazing statement. I'm in Leviticus 14 at verse 33. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and to Aaron, saying, when you become into the land of Canaan, which I give to you for a possession, and I put the plague of leprosy in a house of the land of your possession, and he that owns the house shall come to tell it to the priest, saying, it seems to me that there is a plague in the house. Then the priest shall command that they empty the house before the priests go in to see the plague. All that is in the house will be made unclean, and afterward the priest will go in and see the house. Now, he has said directions just like that all the way through these last couple of chapters. This is how you cleanse things. But he took the time in verse 34 to say, when you come into the land and I put a plague of leprosy in your house, I put a mildew in your house, I put a little growth in your house. God took credit for mildew growing in people's homes. Do you see that? When you go in and I do that, that's absolute sovereignty. If the kind of sovereignty I talk about is true, then in fact, absolutely nothing happens in his universe that he doesn't determine and empower. And right here in the midst of all these little tiny laws in Leviticus, he also took credit for mildew. I find that absolutely fascinating. So next time you're at home cleaning, and you go, what is this scum on the side? God put that there. It's hard to think that way, but it's true. If it grew of its own accord, then that means that there was something in the universe that empowered itself. But God empowers everything. But isn't that an interesting phrase? Now, what do your translations have of it? That's the King James translation. Somebody read verse 34 there of Leviticus 14. What do you got, Jeff? Does God say, when I put it there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when I put it there. I mean, it's so clear that every translator had to go with it. Yeah, God takes credit for doing it. When I put a growth in your house.
It's weird. They say called leprosy there, and then later on in 37, he's talking about the greenish and reddish impressions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's more clear talking about mildew.
You're talking about a mildew, yeah. That word leprosy seems to cover a very wide... It's anything that's sort of a germ-based growth, whether it's on your skin or whether it's you know, a mildew growth or whatever. So, isn't that fascinating stuff? So, all right. Now, we have established that David, in Psalm 114, drew a parallel between incense and prayer. So that takes us back to Revelation 5. Now, one of the things that the book of Hebrews does is that the book of Hebrews says that the things, the items, the furniture that were inside the tent of meeting, the tabernacle in the wilderness, he said were a type of the heavenly things. In other words, they were an emblem of the way heaven itself is established or the way it is set up. He said that our high priest, Christ, has gone before us into the holiest place, into the throne room of God, up into heaven to God for us, to make intercession for us. So we no longer need an earthly high priest. We have a heavenly high priest. But he said all the furniture and everything was also typifying heavenly elements. So John gets to heaven, John being Jewish and having this history of knowing that right before the Ark of the Covenant, there is an altar of incense. He then sees incense in heaven, and it is identified for him that this is prayers of the saints. So that gives validity to the parallel that David drew, and it finally tells us what all that Exodus Leviticus stuff was about. The reason God was so zealous over his altar of incense and the type of incense and that it be coming to him constantly is that it identified the prayers of his saints coming to him constantly. That then was all catch up from last week. So that takes us to chapter 6. I didn't know there was ice in that water. I just sipped it and it was light. Chapter 6 is the beginning of series that are going to take up the next 13 chapters, basically. First, we're going to see these seals. Going to be seven seals, followed by seven trumpets, followed by seven vials or bowls, depending on your translation. And they all follow a pattern, which is that the first six are presented. There are earthly events that run concurrently to each of these events in heaven happening. And then between the sixth and the seventh, John throws in parenthetical information. You get through the six seals, and then all of a sudden, we talk about the 144,000 for a while. And then the seventh seal introduces the trumpets. And then you get into six trumpets, and then you get to the last trumpet, and it takes us to the vials, to the bowls, to the judgments. And that's the pattern that they run all the way along. Now, fortunately, the seals are spelled out very clearly for us. And the seals run very parallel to what we've already learned from Daniel 9, Matthew 24, even Jeremiah, and they're summed up for us, just so there's no confusion about what the time frame is of the seals, they're summed up for us in verse 17 of chapter 6. So take a look there. Actually, verse 16 and 17. All the men on earth, well, now we're going to go to verse 15. The kings of the earth, the great men and the rich men, and the chief captain and the mighty men, and the bondmen, the slave, every free man, that's pretty much everybody on earth is the point. John is trying to wrap up everybody on earth by saying that. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the chief captains, the mighty men, every slave, every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains and said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? So we're clearly talking about the day of the Lord. This is day of the Lord preparatory information. The six seals wrap up basically the events of the first 3.5 years of Daniel's 70th week. And by the time those six seals play out, the day of the Lord has officially begun. That's what wraps up in verse 17. So we're going to try to get through these six seals tonight, which I think we can do, and kind of bite off this whole chapter because it's very self-explanatory. Fortunately, the angel talking to John and then John writing tell us very specifically what each of the seals symbolizes. But it all is leading up to the great and terrible day of the Lord. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts said to me, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. So he's on a white horse. Now, you can find commentaries, if you want to go look around on the internet a bit, you can find commentaries that will identify that conqueror on a white horse as Christ. That couldn't be more wrong, because Christ is the Lamb that took off the seal to let the horse and the horseman go. So I guess Jesus took off a seal to allow himself to get out. No, who the man on the white horse is Antichrist. He is the one who is coming on a white horse looking like a man of peace. It's pointed out that he has a bow, but no arrow. So a lot of people have said, well, then he comes and makes peace. A crown is given to him, so clearly he's given a kingship. He goes forth conquering and to conquer. What does Daniel tell us about the little horn? First thing he does to establish himself is he takes three of the ten-toed nations by force, and then the other seven give him the authority. Right? So all of that is speaking of the Antichrist to come, but he comes in peaceful. He comes in and makes his seven-year peace pact. He reestablishes the pact with Artaxerxes, or that Artaxerxes originally made with Israel, that they could rebuild their temple. And he's going to make a deal with Israel that they can rebuild their temple, bring peace to the Middle East, and look like a great peaceful guy. And then 3.5 years into the deal, according to Daniel, he breaks the covenant that he made with those people, sets up his idol in the temple. And then Paul picks it up in Thessalonians and says that he puts himself in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So this is the Antichrist character that is riding on the white horse.
Question.
Yes?
Is the crown that we see there a different word from the crown we saw last week in Revelation 4, which is the head given to a lamb?
It's a really good question. My guess is that it is not diadem.
It's Stephanos.
Is it Stephanos? Okay, you've got your Greek there. It is Stephanos then, yeah. It's not the kind of rulership that Christ has when he has a diadem, right? Thank you, Jeff. You get the assist. Verse 3, and when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. So this is obviously emblematic of war, destruction. Obviously, we know that 3.5 years in, the Antichrist does exactly that, makes war with the saints. In Matthew 24, Jesus is specific to tell the people in Jerusalem, when you see the abomination of desolation written of by the prophet Daniel, then you know to flee into the wilderness. That's the beginning of the real trouble between Israel and the Antichrist. Verse 5 then says, and when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see that you hurt not the oil and the wine." The King James kind of loses its depth there. This is a picture of famine, that there's just no food to be had. What do your translations say in terms of the money values?
A day's wages.
A day's wages, yeah. Because remember when Jesus, you remember the parable of him taking workers into the field and he hired them from sunup to sundown? And the deal he made with them was, you know, you work for a day for a penny. I mean, that was consistent language that the King James carried around. The idea is, and what is that, an NIV you're reading?
Yeah.
They bring that out, the force of it, much more dramatically than the King James does. Because the idea is a man will work all day and take a whole day's wage to get a handful, basically, of grain. Not enough to subsist on, but that food and grain is going to become very, very valuable. There's going to be worldwide famine, a spread of famine. A measure of wheat for a day's wage, three measures of barley for a day's wage, see that you don't hurt. What does your translation have for see that you don't hurt?
Do not damage the oil or the wine.
Yeah. I find it interesting, since this is all taking place in the Middle East, by the way. This is don't hurt the oil. I can't pass that by. I find that amusing.
Unfortunately, right now,
Yeah. So then verse 7 says, "And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword." That's what you saw back here on the black horse, or the red horse. "And to kill with hunger," that was the black horse, "and with death," that's that pale horse, "and with death and with the beasts of the field." So a quarter of the human population on planet Earth right there, according to that, gets wiped out. Between the war, between the famine, between even the wild beasts of the earth looking for things to eat, a quarter of the population wiped out. "And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held." One of the things that Daniel makes very clear is that the Antichrist, once he goes into power, once he breaks the 7-year peace pact at the 3.5-year mark, that he starts going to war with the saints, and that anyone who will not bow to his will, and of course we've seen it already in the book of Revelation, though it's coming up again when we jumped out of chronology here, that the false prophet causes all, great or small, rich, poor, free, bond, to take a mark in their right hand and their forehead, which is the mark of the Antichrist, and they have to bow down and worship the image of the beast who the false prophet gave power, so that the image itself speaks and appears to have life, and the false prophet does these grand miracles in front of everybody, so much so that he would deceive the very elect if such a thing were possible, according to Christ. So in the midst of all that, anyone who will not take that mark, right hand and forehead, is summarily slain. And of course, the only people who wouldn't do that, obviously, are going to be those who have the testimony of God or of Christ, who recognize that, no, this is not to be taken. These are obviously the Israelites. Again, Israelitish book, full of Jewish language, still going to be here and readable and findable. At that point in history, they're going to be looking at Matthew 24 and saying, this is all happening, and Jesus said, head for the wilderness. But he said, check with the prophet Daniel. They're going to go to Daniel, and they're going to see, run to Ammon, run to Moab, run to Edom. So they're going to know to head into the mountainous regions and head into the wilderness, because that's the time where God is going to keep his remnant of Israel. But there's going to be a large number of them who are going to be slain for that testimony. So up in heaven, there is an altar, and underneath it, the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony that they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Which is astounding language, because this postmodern concept of the big marshmallow, I love everybody, God, would never allow that kind of talk in his heaven. But remember, I told you that all of chapter 4 and 5 that we just saw is all about God preparing to pour out judgment and there being nonstop worship in heaven and praise in heaven about the fact that God is about to pour out judgment. And now these souls that are under the altar are crying out to God and saying, avenge me, go get them, pour out wrath, do that thing you said you were going to do. And look at his answer. Talk about sovereignty. His answer is, verse 11, white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet a little season until their fellow servants and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. Do you get that language? They're told, God's still in control. Yes, you were killed. It's all part of the plan. I'm just storing up more and more guilt and judgment on the people I'm about to pour judgment on, and you're going to wait here and rest until the full number of those I've determined will be killed are killed. There's absolute sovereignty. You're going to wait here with me and rest until the full number, but look at the language too, of your fellow servants, which means servants of God, and their brethren. Now that's very, very specific language again. Brethren there is not talking church brethren, not talking about Brother Tom, not talking about Brother Shane, not talking about Brother Mike here. We're talking about brethren within Israel, language that Jesus used to designate Israelites, his brethren. So again, we're talking about Israelites, Jews, left on the planet after the church is gone who are being persecuted specifically by the little horn, Antichrist, as they're fleeing into the wilderness, as the day of the Lord is preparing to happen, and they, specifically Israelite brethren, are being killed and taken up to this altar where God is dealing with them and saying, there's a number of you specifically that are going to be killed in that like manner, going to be martyred for my sake. You rest here until I've accomplished that completely. Get that picture? Okay. Don't try to shove the church in there, is my point. The church isn't in that verse. The church has already been taken off the planet. Church is already gone. This is all about Israel. And by the way, where does the Antichrist show up on the planet?
Israel, Middle East.
Middle East, yeah. So all that language in Matthew 24 talking about fleeing, those of you who are in Jerusalem, in Judea, flee to the wilderness, Edom, Ammon, Moab. Does that mean anything to somebody living in Wichita?
No.
No. This is not church language. This is all Israel language. Because it's in Israel that Antichrist is going to come, make his 7-year peace pact, break that peace pact, and persecute Israel. Because this is about the ancient descendants of Esau, the ancient Edomites, who have always been enemies against Israel, continuing to fight against their ancient enemies. Now, yes, this will have worldwide impact. But everything God does with Israel has always had worldwide impact. From the moment he chose them as a people, that has had worldwide impact. Abraham was told that through his descendants would come a Messiah, would come a descendant, a seed, and that through his seed, all the families of the earth, all the tribes of the earth would be blessed through that seed. As soon as God chose Abraham, it had a worldwide impact. But the fact that the whole world is impacted by it does not in any way negate the fact that this is all about God and his people, Israel. Got that? So white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. That's just fascinatingly sovereign language. How does God know specifically how many? And when will he know when the last appropriate one has been killed and still leave his remnant in place on the earth? He knows every one of them specifically. He's calling them out by name. He's going to take 144,000 in a minute, stamp his name on their heads, pick them out individually, say, mine, 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 out of Israelites. Which again is fascinating because the northern tribes, since the Assyrian captivity, have lost their heritage, they've lost their place, they've lost their land, they don't even know who they are anymore. You're not going to find them keeping Jewish feasts. They're not going to look like we consider classic Jews to look. They're not going to be wearing Jewish garb. They're not going to have ringlets on the side of their heads. They're not going to be keeping kosher. They're not going to be following the law. They're going to be Israelites who are mixed in with all the Gentile nations of the world until God picks them out and says, you're mine because you are a Manassehite. And they're going to go, I is? Yes, stamp, you're mine. Yes, ma'am.
How do we know we're not? I mean, a lot of us in our heritage, we all came from all over. I mean, I got the Jewish eyes and the Jewish nose.
Well, it's not just that. King David is described as being fair and ruddy, which means light-skinned and freckled, red-haired. That's King David. No, we don't think of him that way because we saw the movie where Richard Gere played him, and we think he looks like Richard Gere. But when we think of Middle Easterners, we normally think of darker skin, maybe olive complexion, or maybe even more swarthy, that complexion.
But there's also Circassians who are very fair.
Absolutely. In the tribe of Joseph, Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, with an Egyptian wife who would have been black.
Moses' wife would have been black.
Moses' wife was an Ethiopian, right? Well, and Zipporah. And then he married an Ethiopian, and his sister was mad about him marrying a black woman. So if you're going to say that there are specific physical, racial traits and characteristics that'll help you identify Israelites of all 12 tribes? You can't do it. You can't even do it in the Bible.
Yeah.
And by the way, since I said all that too, don't forget that when Jesus said to his disciples, when he sent them out by twos to go out and preach the gospel of the kingdom, very specific language, he said, don't go unto the way of the Gentiles. Don't go unto the way of the Samaritans. Go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, very specific designation of the northern tribes. Go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and preach the gospel of the kingdom. So that means they were findable. They had settled somewhere. And they had to be able to get to them from the Middle East, from Israel. So, verse 12. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of the heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken by a mighty wind, and the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island was moved out of their place. Does that sound familiar? It should by now, because we've read it a bunch of times. Joel predicted it as being the beginning of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Peter picked it up and quoted it on the day of Pentecost and said, this is that which was spoken of by the prophet Joel. Jesus talked about it as being the sign of his coming. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens after the sun doesn't give its light and the moon becomes a sackcloth and blood and the stars don't give their light. And then will the sign of the Son of Man appear in the heavens as lightning is from the east to the west. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. And now here it is put in its chronological context. Antichrist comes. He comes as a peacemaker. He takes three by force. The other seven give him his kingdom. Then he starts making war with the saints. Then there's famine. A fourth of the population of earth ends up between the wars and the famine and the destitution on earth. Among those who die, there are also going to be the saints of God, his people, Israelites, who for the testimony of God don't take the mark in their right hand and their forehead. They end up underneath the altar of God saying, when are you going to avenge our blood? He says, hang on, wait, first I got to get everybody out. Oh, that's one more point I wanted to bring up. You'll notice that God says to them, and when they say, when are you going to avenge our blood? One of the things he's specific about is, as soon as I get everybody out, then I mean to get out. I'm not going to pour out my wrath on the earth until everybody I mean to get out of the earth, I've gotten out, and then I pour out my vengeance. Because that's the way God has always worked. Sodom and Gomorrah, what did he do? Before he poured out his vengeance, he made sure that he got out the people that had to get out. So much so that he even had to send an angel in to get them because they were being so obstinate that he had to go in, take them by the hand, and get them out of there. And as soon as they left the city, fiery hail fell, and that whole city was taken down. The first drop of rain didn't fall until God closed the door on the ark and tucked Noah and his family away. Once he had his people safe, he pours out his wrath. You see that consistently all the way through the Bible. And you're not going to see him pour out his wrath on the earth until all his people are safely out. The church is out first, and then here he says to these that are being killed, he says, I'm not going to pour out my vengeance and wrath, which would be inappropriate to do on my people, until all my people who are meant to be killed, martyred the way you are martyred and brought up here to be under the altar with you. Once that's established, then I'll pour out my wrath. So all of the same images in heaven that we've seen consistently as being signs of the coming of the day of the Lord occur in verse 12 through 14. Verse 15 then says, and the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men, every free man, every slave hides themselves in the dens and in the rocks in the mountains. And they say to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us, hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And that is officially the beginning of the day of the Lord in the book of Revelation. But the first thing God does, again, before he pours out his wrath, and we'll pick it up here next week, is at chapter 7, he starts by sealing 144,000 witnesses who are going to witness for him during the beginning of the second 3.5 years of Daniel's 70th week, if that sentence made sense. during this time of trouble now on earth, in tribulation on earth, a time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again, a time of trouble that Jeremiah called the day of Jacob's trouble. Boy, that is specific language. During that time of trouble on the earth, he's going to have 144,000 witnesses, and because they have the mark of God in their forehead, the same way that the Antichrist wants to mark his people in their forehead and their right hand, God marks his people, and they can't be touched, they can't be hurt. The demon locusts that you're going to see, all the bad stuff that's going to start on earth, these people are protected by the hand of God. And then he doesn't say anything more about them until, next thing you know, they're in heaven. They're just up there in heaven. 144,000 as a group up in heaven. How did that happen? They just suddenly appear before him, and he doesn't talk about them being killed or slaughtered or anything. He just finally takes them off the planet, and then he's down to two final witnesses. And he leaves those two witnesses there just long enough to testify and do some miracles, and then they are killed. They're left laying in the street for 3 days. The whole world throws a party, gives each other gifts. Hooray, these people who persecuted us with that whole God thing are finally dead. After 3 days, they stand up on their feet. They, in the sight of all men, rise up into heaven. And then it gets heavy because God has now taken out everybody he's going to take out. And then God pours out the big wrath. You got the picture? So that's right where we're at. The seals have been opened, that seal that is the scroll, and the scroll is written on the back and on the inside with these woes of God, and the Lamb of God now has peeled off those seals and opened that scroll, and out comes all the trouble. That's the picture there.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.